Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, The Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And we're delighted today to be joined by the food historian, Dr. Annie Gray. She's the author of a number of books, including The Greedy Queen and The Alps and the Dales, 100 Years of Betty's. Her latest book, Victory in the Kitchen, The Life of Churchill's Cook, is out this month. Annie, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we'll start where we always do, at the beginning. What are your earliest memories of food?
Ooh, my grandmother's food, probably. My parents were really bad cooks, or at least my mother was a really stonkingly awful cook. So my memories of home-cooked food tend to revolve around things like chicken fricassees with OXO cube bits floating in them. So that was the umami of its day. And a horrific beer casserole that was really sort of acrid. And eating fish and chips with a lot of ketchup, mainly for the peas. So they're all quite bad food memories. And my early good ones revolve around my grandmother's house on my father's side. We used to go and stay with her. She lived in Gloucestershire, and she would always do steak and chips, and then the next day it would always be roast beef and Yorkshire puddings. So my sort of cosy food memories are very much associated with my grandmother's house and this very sort of traditional food. If you stayed more than about 4 days with her, the good stuff would run out and you'd be on fish fingers and bird's eye potato waffles. But she was brilliant as long as you were there for like 2 days.
And did you learn to cook when you were younger?
I didn't, no. I think I was very interested in food from quite a young age. I do remember cooking cakes for school, rock cakes and things out of the Hamlin All Colour Cookery book and things like that. So I would sit on the worktop and sort of bake cakes and add things into sponge cakes. And a lot of those were going to school with me. But my parents were basically going through a really lengthy, messy divorce for pretty much my entire childhood. So it's quite a kind of rackety upbringing in some ways. Lots of microwave meals, lots of sort of things that came out of the freezer that today I would be aghast at the mere idea of eating. But I used to help my father cook on a Saturday. He would always do something on a Saturday. So he'd cook something. He's a food scientist, or was a food scientist. Everything would be in little bowls. So if you cooked a stir fry, everything. I mean, now you'd be like, this is brilliant, this is a proper mise en place. But as a child, you're like, why is everything in a little bowl? Like, literally everything. There's one frozen prawn in this bowl.
Now it's Instagrammable.
Yeah, well, now you'd do it from above and it would look very beautiful.
Lovely flat legs. Yeah.
It would look so good. And then myself and my father moved to France. He used to work for Nestlé, so they offered him a job in France. They closed the factory he was working in Norwich. And I went to go and live in France. And that was my culinary epiphany. It sounds really cliched, but I boarded with a French family and then I lived with my father at the weekends. The thing I really remember was an omelette. My mother used to cook omelettes and they were frisbees. I mean, you could chuck them at the wall, they'd come back. You couldn't eat them. I hated omelettes. I still have problems with omelettes today. But Madame Gorski, who was the woman who was hosting me, cooked this thing. And I thought, what is this? It is runny on top. It tastes of, well, butter. And there's loads of butter. What, this is like butter soup. And it was exquisite. And I think it was kind of that moment when I thought, actually, cooking is amazing. So clearly I was interested, but I couldn't do it. And I think I probably would have got into cooking anyway. But living in France, surrounded by French produce, surrounded by an obsessive nation, it's got to be said, when it comes to food. By the time I got back to university, I was like proper hardcore nerd. I think it was the proselytising of the newly converted, to the point that I had a pasta machine above my bed at university. I used to make fresh pasta in my room, so a little bit over the top.
So how old were you when you were living in France?
I went when I was 16, so I'd done my GCSEs, I'd done a term of A-levels, and then I left at that point. So very much of the age where you are conscious enough of what is going on to think about things and think things through and make your own decisions, but young enough that I very quickly picked up things like French. So I speak very fluent French because I lived there for 2 years. So in some ways it was absolutely the best age because I was able to really explore things on my own. And that as well is one of the areas, one of the reasons I got so into history, because we were studying Louis XIV for my A-levels. I was at the British School of Paris, so we did A-levels. Studying Louis XIV in Paris. I mean, you can't get better because, oh, I think I'm going to go on a field trip this weekend. Let's go to Versailles. It's down the road. So it was absolutely magical to be able to study French history in a site where everything happened and then go out and eat it all. It was just fantastic.
What sort of struck you as the kind of French approach to eating compared to the kind of English approach?
I think just the level of obsession, the level of this has got to matter, got to do it three times a day, let's do it. And my father was sending quite a lot of money back to the UK to support my mother. So our budget sort of differed month on month. So we would go out and shop very, very carefully. And just shopping at markets then, I mean, now with farmers markets in the UK, lots and lots of people shop at markets and it's fine. But the old style English market, which meets usually on a weekday, is something that still is very much populated by mums with buggies and older people and the occasional person like me, who works for themselves or perhaps is popping out of the office at weekdays. In France, everybody shops at markets. You would never buy your meat from a supermarket. You buy it from a butcher's or the market. So there's a whole sea change in how we thought about food, myself and my father, where previously he might have bought fish from the market, but never meat. Now everything was there and you'd go out on a Saturday and it was an occasion. And everything was so beautifully displayed and you could sit and look at just stare at the tomatoes for hours. And the level of interest, the interactions people had with shopkeepers, I think was very, very different. My grandmother always used to talk to people in shops and it used to make me chronically embarrassed as a child because she'd be there having a conversation with the Tesco checkout girl. Oh God, this is so embarrassing, Grandma, just stop it. But in France, everybody talks about food all the time and it's regardless of class. And so while, of course, there are loads of people in France who do eat badly and who don't have a brilliant diet, the French themselves mythologise their food to such a degree that having a conversation in a butcher for 4 hours about what you're doing to the joint of meat that night is totally normal. And I loved that, the human interaction over this vital product. And I think at the end of the day as well, I'm quite greedy. So, yeah, just being able to do that and have it be socially acceptable was quite nice as well.
It obviously made you a more knowledgeable eater that time in France. Did it make you a more adventurous eater or were you already sort of there?
I don't think I was adventurous at all. My parents never ate offal, for example. In fact, my father still won't go near offal. And when I got to France, cheese, oh God, if it's not dairy, I'm not going near it. Which now I look back and I think I wasted 2 years when I could have been eating this incredible, what was I doing? Because the host family I stayed with, they produced the meals. So you ate what you were given, which meant endive salad, which at the age of 16 and endive was so bitter, I really couldn't cope with it. But I loved the idea of eating all the food and I embraced things like frog's legs and snails very quickly because they're quite nice. I mean, they're just the vehicle for butter really, aren't they? But I did become a lot more adventurous through it because how can you not? When you are watching people pick mussels off the beach and then you know that's what you're eating in the restaurant that night, when you are seeing this sort of effusive love of food everywhere, it does make you want to try things. But I think in many ways the adventurousness came later when I came back to university and when at the age of sort of 18, 19, you're trying to find yourself, you're trying to find a personality and you're kind of offsetting that against others a lot of the time. So when I went back to university, I became the person that was really into food. And that was a way, I think, of forging my own identity in a different set of circumstances when I was on my own. So at university, conversely, I became even more adventurous than I had been. So I'd go and I'd cook pheasant because they were cheap. You could get a brace of pheasant for far less than you pay for chicken. So I would cook pheasant. And then when I started to be interested in food history, that was when I started to look at offal and some of the other things around it. Because I thought, you can't study food history, turn your nose up at kidneys, at least have a go. So now I very much have the attitude that I will try it probably 3 times before I say, no, really, this isn't for me. So there are certain things I won't eat because I've tried them enough times to know that they really aren't something I'm ever going to be able to cope with, even
what
in the
are
house.
Those things that you've discovered,
you know. Male hairs are bad for me because I think this actually comes from when I used to work at Audley End in costume. We used to do game week, so we would roast and we would boil and we would pluck and we would do all sorts of things. And we roasted a male hare at one point, and the male of the species is usually stinkier than the female. I had to skin it as well. With a hare in the Victorian era and in the Georgian, actually, you would skin it, you'd keep the head on, so you'd have the eyeball sort of there and empty, and then the ears are still on and they're sort of quite perky, the legs are on, and you sort of cut the tendons at the shoulders and at the back legs and flick the back legs forward and take the front legs back and pin. It's quite an involved process. So when you roast it, it looks like a kind of mummified hare. And I'm sure if you're Victorian, that's really cool. And you're like, whoa, yes, brilliant. And also it doesn't look like cat. So if you buy hare or rabbit in France or Spain today, often it will be with the head and the legs still on. So you can tell it's not a cat. So we had this hare. I had skinned it. All the rest of it is on, perky as anything. And it goes to the oven and it reeked. Oh, my God. Oh, it was just, we had a very small mess room. So when we were not on set in costume, we were all in this tiny little room with this oven pumping out this revolting smell, and I just got to the point where actually just the smell of it was too much. So I thought, no, it's fine, it's just the smell, I'll eat it. I couldn't. And the same goes, unfortunately, for woodcock. These are all the things that people are probably going, oh, why would you eat those anyway? When you roast a woodcock, in the Victorian era, you do it on a hanging spit, so in front of the fire. And the idea was, and this still happens in restaurants today, but you do it on a hanging spit, and at some point it basically sort of relaxes and its guts spill out onto the toast beneath. And the first time I did this in an oven at home, this is amazing. Look, it's done what it's supposed to. Look, its guts are on the toast. It's incredible. Wow, this is, I'm going to eat. They're just so, so strong. It's not even the gaminess. It's the, just the, well, it's, yeah. I'm just eating woodcock guts on toast. That one is a stretch too far.
So you're at university. What sparked your interest in food history? Was there a particular era that you just became obsessed with?
Well, I loved the Georgian era when I was at university, but I went to Oxford, and the course at the time was very much centred on sort of great white men striding the earth, hitting other great white men. And it was quite a turn off, to be honest. I left going, that's it, I'm not, I hate this, I couldn't stand it. I went off, I got a quote unquote real job. And then I got sacked from every job I had for a little while, which was extremely exciting. Turns out I'm unemployable. And the thing is, at the end of the day, I just thought, do you know what? I love history. The course may have been off-putting, but I still adore history and I still want to communicate it to the public. And all the way through, it was about public communication for me. So I went to go and do a master's in historical archaeology at York, and that for me was life-changing. The course was fantastic, the tutor was amazing, and it was very much about sort of disenfranchised groups, things like that. So we would study slavery, we studied urban working class populations, we studied gay men, we studied servants, very much the people that traditional documentary-led history often doesn't reach, because there's no real documents attached to these people apart from if they're written by their employers. And I loved it, absolutely, absolutely loved it. And we did, it was a taught master, so we were supposed to sort of go away and come back and present to the class. And on one occasion we were studying tea, coffee and chocolate. So, and I got chocolate. So off I went, home I went, and I read up and I found this recipe from 1651, which started of cacao's 400. And I thought, well, this is quite cool, isn't it? So I toddled downstairs and said to my dad, I've got a chocolate recipe. Do you reckon we could cook it? And he was still working for Nestlé at the time. I went, yeah, yeah, I'll get you some cocoa liquor and help me to talk through the recipe and how modern chocolate is made and how the flavours would work together. So off he went and he got some cocoa liquor, which is 100% cocoa that's just been ground, so nothing else has been done to it. And I made this stuff, took it into the class in a thermos flask. This could be cool, isn't it? So I did my presentation on chocolate and the iconography of chocolate and everything else. And here is some chocolate. We're going to taste it. And everyone got high. I think because it was so unexpected. It had chilli in and cloves, orange flower water, cinnamon, aniseed and lots of sugar. And it was very dark. And it just gave you such a sort of powerful punch. So the tutor signed us up for this international conference a month later and said, you need to come present on chocolate. What? Just four master's, it was bonkers. So we did this paper at this conference and everyone was really interested. And at that point, I hadn't really realised food history as a discipline existed. And it certainly wasn't then. This is sort of, 15 years ago, it wasn't anything like as sort of prominent as it is now. And I just thought, this is amazing. This is something I already love, cooking, food, eating, plus history, which I adore and I know I want to make a career in. And it's publicly accessible. So it's a case of everybody eats. You know, there's nothing else that you can say that about. Death, fine, but there's limits to where you can go with death. Sex, well, not everybody has sex. And also it's very difficult to do with children in a public forum. So you're kind of left with food. It's brilliant because you can get everybody on board with it, even if they're not interested in food. I don't care, I just eat micro, I don't, it's just sustenance. But if you put that hare in front of them with its ears on, the person who said, oh, it's just sustenance, goes, what is that? It's disgusting. At which point you can say, well, let's talk about our cultural conceptions of food, what's edible, what's not edible, how does that make us feel, what does that tell us about people in the past, what does it tell us about ourselves, which obviously is ultimately the question we're always asking as historians. So it's just, I was like, this is amazing, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And it took a few years, but then I managed it. So that was kind of cool.
So you did a PhD in food history. What was your first job in the food world after that?
Before my PhD, I worked at Hampton Court and the Tower of London for a company called Past Pleasures, who supply costume interpreters. And that means that you are in costume, usually you're in character, and you are interpreting the past to the public. So it's not the same as reenactment, which tends not to be salaried. So reenactors can be quite rude. And they do it as a hobby. So it's usually at the weekends. Lots of people grinding things and saying, no, I do not know what that is. It will eat my mind. What is that? And you're like, it's a camera. Just do one. So interpretation is paid and usually has a set of site-specific objectives. So it's a bit more professional. There are lots
and
of
deliberately
brilliant...
educational, presumably.
Yes, there are some brilliant reenactors out there. There's a lot of crossover between the worlds, but in theory it should be deliberately educational. There should be a set of GLOs, which is history slang or heritage slang, global learning objectives, and it's very directed. So I used to work at Hampton Court, predominantly playing the estranged wife of William Parr, Catherine Parr's brother, so known at Hampton Court as the Bonking Baroness. And I used her to interpret women's rights in the Tudor period. She was great. And I used to play the Countess of Carlisle as well. And as a result of working for them, when a new project cropped up at Audley End House in Essex, they put me in charge because I was living relatively locally and because it was a service wing project. It was about servants. And the kitchens were part of that. So I set up this team of costume interpreters. And inevitably, I was doing my PhD at the time. This is the second year of my PhD. Inevitably, because of what I was doing, it ended up being very food focused. In fact, it ended up featuring quite a lot in my PhD thesis because I couldn't justify the amount of time I was spending there.
What was your thesis?
It was rather grandiosely titled, Man is a Dining Animal, the Archaeology of the English at Table, 1750 to 1900. It looked at the process of dining change from à la Française service to à la Russe in the 19th century from a class and gender perspective. Yes, exactly. Very few people have read it.
Oh, it sounds great.
Very clunky. Yeah. But, you know, it was good and it was interesting and it was a basis for then moving on to work more widely within Food World. So that was my first job working with food history, was playing the first kitchen maid. This site cooking in real time, in costume, in character with the public. And it was everything from very small scale conversations about what you were doing, what you were cooking, to huge, large performance pieces. Absolutely brilliantly good fun. But, you know, after I don't know how many years I did, sort of 7 or 8 years, it did get a little tedious after a while.
And how do you go about researching food history? I mean, are they looking at recipes or sort of accounts from servants?
What, it sort of depends what it is. For example, at the moment, I'm trying to look at what George III ate when he was quote unquote mad. So then for that, there is a ledger that's kept at the National Archives, the Kew Ledger, which lists out all the meals that were served at Kew Palace. So you can see what was served. You can't necessarily see what he was eating, but you can see what was being served. So that's quite a good document. And then I will cross-reference that to doctors' reports and to wider writings on what you feed ill people at the time to see if you can come up with a pattern. For Queen Victoria, it was similar when I wrote The Greedy Queen, because again, there are dining ledgers that exist along with supply books, although they're not exhaustive. Plus, of course, you've got diaries, you've got memoirs from people, you've got Queen Victoria's own journals as well, where she sometimes talks about food. A lot of it is a real question of detective work from lots and lots and lots of different sources. I would do the Kitchen Cabinet on Radio 4, which is Radio 4's culinary panel show. For that, we normally have three themes, and that's a question of go away and find out, not just find out lots and lots of things about them, but find out the things that will interest people, find the hook. So if we're doing a theme on, say, bananas, for example, I might look at the history and say, okay, this is all very interesting. I can tell you when bananas were introduced, I can tell you what they were used for, but all of this is fine. What I really need is something that people will remember. So then they think, oh, I know a bit about bananas, or wasn't that interesting? So I'll come up with a recipe, for example, the infamous candle salad that we did on the Kitchen Cabinet in Pangbourne. She's a banana stuck into a piece of pineapple with a piece of pepper as a handle and a cherry on top. And the pièce de résistance is you cover the banana in mayonnaise. So yes, it does look like exactly what you're thinking. And everyone sniggered a lot. But that's, you know, then they'll remember it.
No one ever forgets that.
Exactly. Yeah. When you see your first candle salad, it's a moment to remember.
And when you're choosing a topic for a book like The Greedy Queen or Victory in the Kitchen, what is it that draws you to those particular stories?
I don't know. It's Greedy Queen was my first book, and myself and my agent batted around ideas for years. And I kept coming back to Queen Victoria because I'd previously done a research report for English Heritage Osborne House into the kitchens there. And I knew, therefore, there was material. And also no one had looked at Queen Victoria through her food. But mainly my motivation was to write about 19th century food. It wasn't really Victoria. Narrative history books are often very tedious and won't sell. And at the end of the day, if you're writing books, you do need to write something people want to read.
It's the same thing, it's a hook.
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted to write about 19th century food. I knew quite a lot about Queen Victoria. She ate an awful lot of 19th century food. So she seemed like a very good figure to use as a way of jumping off into other stories. Downton Abbey, they came to me. Betty's, they came to me. And I interviewed for them, and it was bliss. So it wasn't my idea, it was their idea, but honestly it was 6 months of glory. And what else have I done? There's one for English Heritage again that's connected to the Audley End project, so that's come in to me, and a little book of food writing that I've just edited. Victory in the Kitchen was slightly different. I sort of think of those, Victory and Greedy Queen, as my real books, quote unquote, just because they're the ones I came up with and they're the ones I researched fully from scratch. But that one I wanted to write about 20th century food and domestic service as well, because I think it's one of those areas that's still very misunderstood. Servants are all either drudges with bleeding knees who cry themselves to sleep every night, or they're Mrs. Cosy Patmore being given their glasses by their employer and they're going to go on and have a full service pension and retire to the Isle of Wight. And actually, of course, the reality is somewhere in between, because so many women work to servants, you cannot sum it up like that. So that was a question of... standing in archives, just hoping something would leap into my head. And I found Georgina's cookery book. She wrote a cookery book called Recipism No. 10 in 1958 on the shelf and pulled it off and thought, this is really interesting. Wow, Churchill had a cook who wrote a cookbook. Wow, amazing. Put it back on the shelf. Oh, someone would have written about her. And then I thought, I'll have a look. And it was only then I discovered that not only was she the wartime cook, but also Churchill's longest serving cook, and no one had written about her. And she'd been pretty much written out of Churchill's life, despite the fact she was a really, really crucial figure. So that kind of combination of, it was what I wanted to write about, she sounded interesting, I was really angry and felt that it would kind of carry me through the hell that is writing a book, and the fact that I naively, it turned out, thought there'd be loads of information on her in the Churchill archive, which is down the road from where I live, that was kind of perfect storm. I was very wrong about the latter, but all the others were true.
And what sort of dishes was Georgina cooking for Churchill?
Well, he didn't really know what the ration was, it's got to be said. She used to tell the story of taking the ration up to him on a breakfast tray because he said he wanted to see what it was. So she brought it up and she showed him and he said, oh, it's all right for a day. And she said, not a day, this is a week. And apparently he was astonished. He was somebody who was very careful at sort of curating his own image. So he liked to be seen as the great British beef eater. He wrote a lot about eating beef. Irish stew he was associated with. Big breakfast. Whenever he went to the States, people would go, God, this man eats such a lot for breakfast. But a lot of that was him knowing that people would report on what he would eat. And actually, when he was back in London, and ironically, we're sort of recording just spitting distance from Downing Street. When he was back in London, his breakfasts tended to be things like fresh peaches. So not something the entire rest of the population could get hold of, really. Sent up from Chartwell. Honey, again, not something the rest of the population could get hold of, but there were beehives at Chartwell. He would have lots of toast and preserves, spreads, butters. There wasn't a shortage. And usually a piece of meat for breakfast as well, sometimes held over from the night before. Luncheons, often there were invited guests, and the same with dinners, and dinners were even bigger. So there were diplomatic coupons, and there were extra ways to get, not quite round the ration, but to supplement it for Georgina. He was an Edwardian, in essence. I think people tend to associate him with the modern age because he was a wartime leader and forget that he was quite elderly when he became premier. So he was an Edwardian eater. He liked his caviar, he liked his things in aspics, he liked his fussy foods that are quite heavy and quite rich and reasonably complex as well. And Georgina had trained both as an English cook, she'd made cooking upper class houses by the age of 25, but also as a French cook because her husband was a French chef, he was much older than her. So she learnt both these sort of sets of cookery, the very fussy English style, but also this very beautiful pared back French cookery that was so fashionable at the time. And Churchill was very much of the kind of, let's have what's fashionable. So things like brains with mango chutney sauce, or chicken dishes in relatively plain but nevertheless relatively complex sauces, lots of ice creams as well, and lots of Stilton.
And what about Clementine? Did she eat everything?
She was always on a diet. She put on a stone during the war, which she said was because she didn't exercise enough. So the minute the war ended, she went on a diet and put Winston Churchill on a diet as well. She was really knowledgeable about food. Her mother had been a sort of impoverished noblewoman living in Dieppe and had written articles for the Daily Express on cookery and contributed recipes to their friends' cookery books and that kind of thing. So Clementine really knew food. And if anything, I would say she was the more interesting of the eaters. Winston knew the value of a good dinner. He knew how to use it for networking purposes. He knew what he wanted and he liked good food. He liked plenty of it, although I think a lot of his girth came from drinking. But Clementine was very, very on the ball. She was the one that picked the cookery, but she knew how to cook. Earlier, before they employed Georgina, they couldn't really afford decent cooks. So Georgina had cooked for them before the war as a sort of jobbing chef, and they'd employed this series of relatively untrained girls, and they did the same after the war. They had Swiss and German au pairs after the war who came over to Chartwell and cooked and then went back again after a year when their visas ran out. So they had this sort of constant flow of girls coming over to learn English and also learn to cook, and Clementine would teach them. So she really did know how to cook and was pretty on the ball.
During the research of the book, was there anything that really surprised you that you discovered?
How little there is about the Churchill's household in the Churchill archive really surprised me. I thought, yay, there's going to be loads of Churchill archive. All the papers are going to be there. Everything, it'll be fine. Dead easy to research. No. So there are about 5 or 6 menu books, when clearly there would have been 2 for every single year, at least, because there's the family and the staff books should be there. There are no household accounts. Quite a lot of it is still locked as well because of GDPR. You hit a brick wall when you're researching sometimes and you think, I just had a horrible day. I've spent 8 hours in this archive and it's freezing cold and I haven't learned anything and there's nothing usable here. So, and I hit one of those in about, I think it must have been about June when I was researching the book, and I thought, fine, I'm going to skip ahead. I'm going to call up this menu book from 1954, 52 I think it was, when I know Georgina was definitely working for them, and I'm going to look for her handwriting because I would expect this book to be entirely in her handwriting, and I'd found a few snippets from her before. So I call up this book and it arrives and I open it and everything's written in German and it says Apfeltart and Käsetart, and I'm looking at this thing going, what? What? Not only is it not Georgina's handwriting, why is it in German? They've just won a war against Germany. I don't understand. This is terrible. And I thought, I had to go outside and have a bit of a moment. Come back in again, said to the archivist, why is this all in German? And they said, we don't know. Nobody ever calls those up. People aren't really very interested in it. So I'm like, no. They were brilliant, the archivists. They really sort of entered into the spirit of it with me. And they were, I cannot praise the archivists at the Churchill Archive highly enough. Because this moment when I'm having this meltdown over this Käsetart, kind of talking me down from the ceiling, I'm sure it's going to get better. she did have Swiss au pairs as one of them. Oh, thank God, there's an explanation. But it was just one of those moments you thought, what?
It's like an alternative history.
Oh, yeah. It just, yeah, it was horrid. Sorry, the trauma is all rushing back to me. And then there was the bit where the Antiques Roadshow aired. It was after I handed the manuscript in, and somebody on the Antiques Roadshow had found a skip full of letters from quote-unquote Churchill's cook. And I thought, what? No. I'm fine with you doing that 6 months ago, not now. But it turned out they weren't from the cook. They were a charlady. He's since disappeared. I slightly wonder whether or not the fact that he was skip-dipping was a problem. There was loads of other stuff with the letters that clearly were not real. So there was a Churchill's hat and things like that. But that was a heart-stopping moment. And then the day before it went to print, the archive emailed me and said, oh, we've just had a memoir given to us from another of Churchill's cooks, you want to see it? Oh god,
that can be the follow-up book.
12 hours. So no, it was fine. I read it, I incorporated it into the book, it snuck its way in with about an hour to go.
You wouldn't think with a topic that sort of historical unknown that you could have a last minute panic of that nature.
No,
that's horrible.
But also how fortuitous that the lady in question, Catherine Anderson, who was his cook in the late 50s, that her archive went, or her memoir, I should say, it's only 4 or 5 pages, went to the archive, and that they were so aware of what I was doing and well aware of the fact that I was writing this book that they contacted me immediately and said, this might be a thing.
But they said, oh, are you sitting down?
Yes, I did. And I went, oh my God. And I was at a friend's house at the time, dog sitting. So I was like, I got to do it on my phone. It's just awful.
And after a stressful day, what do you like cooking yourself? Your Instagram account, which I want you to tell us about, because you do post some amazing pictures of all kinds of things on it.
It's a bit random. I'm always aware that my Instagram account should probably be beautiful pictures of food, all taken from above and, you know, gloriously posed. But actually what happens is I really want to eat it, so I just take a picture of it. And normally there's a plug point in the background or something, kind of from the kitchen. But I love cooking. I mean, I always love cooking since I sort of first encountered proper cooking when I was a teenager. And my other half was vegetarian when I met him and converted shortly after he met me, saying essentially that he'd decided that if he was going to be vegetarian for ethical reasons, that he felt it was better to be a meat eater for ethical reasons but eat ethically produced meat. So his argument, which I do admit was influenced by me, was let's go to the supermarket and buy a free-range, properly fed, ethically produced, high-end quality chicken, and let's eke that chicken out over 2 weeks because it's 50 times the price of a battery-farmed one, but we'll value it. So he cooks too, so we tend to cook together most evenings. We're quite food focused, surprisingly enough. So we plan our recipes a week in advance, fully. And normally we have a historic cookbook and a modern cookbook on the go at the same time. So we've got too many cookbooks. So it's about being able to work your way through them. So we will plan it all out and then do the shop that we need. And I'll normally go to the market if I'm in. And we've got a zero waste shop nearby now as well. It's opened up, and the recipe supplement from butchers or the supermarket, wherever, you know what it's like. And we will normally sit down together and we will cook together in the evenings. He's much more nerdy in the kitchen in terms of the techniques. So he's learned to fillet fish really well, whereas I learned to fillet fish in a Victorian costume in front of the public. So I can fillet fish really well too, but it's just that I didn't learn it. I just looked in a Victorian book and went, right, that'll do, and then did it in front of the public for the first time while hoping I wouldn't cut my fingers off.
And are there any historic cookbooks that you always go back to?
Eliza Acton, always. She's fantastic. Mariah Rundle, I value as well. She taught me how to make hot watercress pastry. Countess Morphy, I really like. Ice cream, I'll always go to Agnes Marshall, or sometimes I'll go to Frederick Nutt, but Agnes Marshall, cucumber ice cream, rocks. Not the curry one. Don't ever do the curry one.
There was a Roman meatballs that was a pickiest.
Yes, yes. Because when I'm doing kitchen cabinet, we can get all sorts of topics, and I will usually cook something for an episode. And one of my fellow food historians, Sally Granger, is a Roman specialist. So I, obviously with these things, there's a really lovely food history community, really lovely, and we all do help each other, and it's a really nice sort of place to be. So Sally said, we'll try this meatball recipe, and I'd worked with her the week before at an English Heritage Food Festival, got quite into her Roman mortarium, which I really now want, because it's big and shallow and kind of groovy, and you can, in a kind of, it's got grooves on it rather than a really funky way. It is actually both, because it is really actually groovy. Baby. But you can really get a kind of shifty up when you're going round and round and getting leaks. Anyway, so I thought, I'm going to do a Roman meatball recipe. This would be great. And I tell you what, they were knockout. They were such good meatballs, and they stayed together, which actually is always a problem with meatballs. And then there was a time I did the quenelle, and I followed a Larousse recipe from 1931. And then I texted a chef friend of mine. She, why have you done that? No one does that anymore. I was like, well, yeah, but it's really nice. How long did it take you? About 5 hours. That's why nobody does it anymore. But they were really good. So sometimes you do find out amazing things you're doing them. And I do, when I remember, stick them on Instagram. It's quite interesting because I tweet and I Instagram, but I don't go anywhere near Facebook, really. It's just pictures of people's cats and fetuses. It's too much. And off-colour political adverts. But I find you end up with a very different personality on both. I mean, the thing that's doing the rounds at the moment, the Dolly Parton meme, it is true. On Twitter, I'm far more likely to sort of, I don't know, rant randomly about trains apart from anything else. But also, Instagram is very much an instant photograph thing, but it's quite nice to be able to put something up and say, well, this is the recipe that it's from, and this is when it's from, and even though this one doesn't look great, actually this is quite an interesting topic. And you know, the responses are quite good. Everything for me is about facilitating dialogue and about facilitating, I suppose, conversations.
And you're a keen gardener as well, and you grow historic
badly.
Plants.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. What do you grow?
I had my first garden in my last house, and it was tiny, and I crammed so much stuff into it. It was a modern garden, very, very, with like modern housing estates have very tiny gardens. I had a espalier fruit trees around the corner of it, and I had one of everything. The current one is slightly bigger, but still what would be definitely classed as a very small garden, and I put in raised beds. So I've got, it is a very small garden. I've got sea kale. I've got three varieties of old-fashioned rhubarb. I've got five apple trees now, a quince tree, a medlar, which is really the gift that keeps on giving. Oh my God, get a medlar.
I really
They're beautiful. And every year it gives me so much fruit. Last year, massive crate full of fruit. Coming out my ears. And actually also last year they bletted on the tree for the first time, which meant that because if you blet them off the tree, they don't taste as good. If they blet on the tree, they're really good, and you just stuff them in your mouth and chew them all up and then spit out the pips, and it's fab.
So to eat medlars, you effectively have to rot them.
If they actually get mould on them, they're not quite as good. It's just like any fruit that's on a tree that gets the frost to it, when it starts to go brown, like an apple, if you leave it on the tree and it starts to soften and go brown and squidgy. Medlars have to go brown and squidgy before you can use them. The Victorians used to serve them on table just like that, and they are also called the dog's bum fruit because they do look like a dog's bum, and that's universal across all languages. The French also know them. Yeah, coup de chien. But they've got loads of pips in. They're related to a rose hip, and when you eat them, they are the most exquisite flavour. They're a sort of apricot crossed with a rose, crossed with a sort of really good apple. Very squidgy, almost impossible to eat because there's so many pips in them. You can't sort of scoop them out with the spoon. So the best way actually is just to peel back a bit, stick them in your mouth, suck them. I'm sure the Victorians did not do this, and then spit the pips across the garden. But they also make a really, really lovely quince cheese. You can do a quince jelly with them, which is easier because then you don't have to de-pip them. And this year, because I had so many and I had a really inferior bottle of whiskey knocking around the house, I've done medlar whiskey and medlar brandy as well.
Nice.
Which is still, they're not going to be ready to drink till about May, I think.
And when you're cooking not for historical reasons or for research reasons, what's your ultimate comfort food?
My other half makes a thing called dundery or nudundery, which I don't even know what book he got them out of, which are basically sort of very, very easy Italian dumplings made with ricotta, which he does in a tomato sauce with fresh tomatoes from the garden, obviously. That's very comforting because it has associative value for me, because I used to work, when I was working at Audley, I'd often come back quite late and he would have cooked this. I'd be hungry enough to eat a horse because I'd have been grazing all day on Victorian crap. I'd have been eating Victorian cake and Victorian syrup and pudding and bits of pie crust and bits. It was like really dodgy motorway service station food, but Victorian. And I'd eaten it all. So you get back and it would have exactly that same feeling you have if you graze all day, where you've eaten your body weight and calories, but actually really hungry. To be cooked for is my ultimate comfort food. And at the moment, to cook... Oh, this is kind of historic anyway, though, because there's so much crossover. Okay. Pork, apple, quince, suet pudding.
Oh, well, that does sound pretty good.
It's pretty amazing.
So where does that come from?
Well, it doesn't. It came out of my head. But it is historically inspired.
Because your head's historic now.
Yeah, it is. My head is now warped, is what you're saying. But for that, you just, if you make a suet crust and just line a pudding basin as usual, and then you fry off the pork briefly just to give it a bit of browning, a bit of flavour. Layer the pork in with apple, and then very coarsely chopped apple, very finely chopped quince, because they cook at very, very different temperatures and very, very different rates. Bit of mushroom ketchup in there. Tiny bit of water, maybe a bit of sherry if you want to. Lots of seasonings, lots of salt and pepper. Lid back on and cook it for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and you get this beautiful slow cooked pork with this melty apple, and you still got a bit of texture in the quinces at that point. Cook two is all I can say, because the last time I cooked one, it was gone in seconds and everyone's going, are there leftovers? Where's the rest? I love suet crust. It's just so versatile and so tasty.
Annie, thank you so much for joining us on Table Talk. Dr. Annie Gray's book, Victory in the Kitchen, The Life of Churchill's Cook, is published by Profile Books and available now. Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to The Spectator website.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.